Celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation with the new Martin Luther plush figure. It features the 16th century reformer holding the Bible and Luther's morning and evening prayers. Go to reformationgear.com, use the coupon code ISSUESETC, and 20% of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. reformationgear.com, the new Martin Luther plush figure, reformationgear.com, and enter the coupon code ISSUESETC. We've been walking through the Sermon on the Mount with Martin Luther as part of our series on Martin Luther and the Reformation with Dr. Ken Sherb. Now, Jesus has a lot to say. He's talked about almsgiving. He's talked about prayer. And now he's going to turn to a subject that is a little foreign to us today. Really shouldn't be, because it's something that is commended by Scripture, even commended by Christ. Although in Matthew chapter 6, he has some warnings about this subject of fasting. We're going to talk about it and how Luther deals with it, especially in an age when Luther, writing on the Sermon on the Mount, was dealing with a whole different story on fasting in the Roman Church. Dr. Ken Sherb joins us. He's pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. He has a PhD in history from Ohio State University, formerly served as a theology professor at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Ken, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Epiphany greetings belatedly to you, because I didn't get to talk to you last week.
And to you as well. Here are the two verses, actually the three, that we're going to deal with today on fasting, beginning at verse 16 of Matthew 6. And when you fast, do not look gloomy like the hypocrites, for they disfigure their faces that their fasting may be seen by others. Truly I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, that your fasting may not be seen by others, but by your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. How does this little section on fasting fit together with what Jesus has been saying so far, according to Luther, on both prayer and almsgiving?
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate that our Christmas break from the series, we took a couple of weeks off, came right when it did, because these three sections are kind of closely interwoven. They were in the Sermon on the Mount, and they are in Luther's comments on the Sermon on the Mount. Three great pillars of first century Jewish piety were almsgiving, that is, giving to the poor, prayer, and fasting. We talked about a couple of those before. Now we're at the point about fasting. And yet, there is a similar thread running through all three of these. Jesus has already criticized the almsgiving and the prayer habits of the Pharisees in the first verses of Matthew 6. And a lot of his criticism had to do with the fact that they were trying to call attention to themselves as they were engaged in these pious works. Same problem with the fasting. They're trying to get people to look at them. Now, unlike almsgiving, where you're actually sort of doing something and you can get somebody to see you giving to the poor, or prayer, where you can get somebody to sort of catch you with your hands folded and your head bowed. With fasting, it's a little bit different, because with fasting, you're not doing something, right? You're not eating. And so what the Jews at the time that Jesus was speaking these words would do is just make themselves look terribly haggard and just look like they were in bad shape. Their whole appearance really amounted to trolling for compliments. And Jesus says, no, don't do that either. Now, it's not that Jesus was rejecting fasting, Luther points out, any more than he was rejecting, well, almsgiving or prayer. Really, the question here is how to restore proper fasting.
And fasting was the piety of the day. It seems kind of odd to us in Protestant America, but among first century Jews, there were regular fasts. And then, of course, as Luther notes, the, as he calls them, the hypocrites kind of piled on some extra ones on top.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that grew like Topsy. A good trivia question is, how many times a year were good pious Israelites supposed to fast according to the Old Testament? And it may be surprising, really only one. God said they were supposed to fast around the time of the Day of Atonement. Now, Luther notes that was a common fast. Everybody was doing that. And if everybody is fasting, well, then you can't get any kind of special notice from anybody else if you're fasting too. They're in the same boat you are. So special fasts got undertaken, and people would thereby give the impression that they were more spiritual, certainly more spiritual than other people who weren't doing that kind of fasting. Luther points to a question that people put to Jesus a little bit later in Matthew 9. Why do the disciples of the Pharisees fast so often, but your disciples, Jesus, do not fast? See, that's the point. This fasting got kind of out of control as one would one up another, and pretty soon there was all kind of fasting. And what Jesus is doing is rejecting this bad motivation that lies at the heart of it, fasting for the sake of being noticed and getting a good reputation.
And he has occasion here, as you say, to kind of turn this on his contemporaries. What does he do?
Yeah, we're talking about Luther here. Luther does turn this now to his own day. And he says, Lent started off to be a shorter season than it is now, but Lent got lengthened. In fact, that's what Lent means. It means lengthening. And it got lengthened, very sarcastically, Luther says, because we became holier. And then besides Lent, we added other fasts, some general, some individual. And it was, again, this game of one-upmanship. Well, I'm fasting 19 times a year, Todd. You're only fasting 18 times a year. And Luther says that's exactly what was happening in his own day. And yet, with all of that fasting, Luther says, at bottom, it amounted to nothing. He says, I dare say that in what they termed fasting in the papacy, I never saw a genuine fast. For example, people may have refrained from eating meat, called it a fast, but they were just refraining from eating one particular kind of food. And yet they would gorge themselves on the other food. They're not eating meat. Well, okay, they're eating fish, maybe very expensive fish prepared with fine spices. And they're having strong drink. Luther says even the monks were doing this. And if the monks were doing it, well, you can imagine what the bishops and the prelates were doing.
And he says this was worse than what Jesus is addressing among the Pharisees.
Right. He says the Pharisees may have been badly motivated, but they were at least doing some honest fasting. What we have in our day, Luther says, is not fasting. It's more like feasting. But even that kind of dishonesty, calling something fasting when it's really not, was not the worst thing that Luther pointed out in his own contemporary situation. He said the worst thing, and this won't surprise you, the worst thing is that fasting has become a means, he says, of seeking great merit before God, of atoning for sin, and of reconciling God. So, in absolution, this kind of fasting was imposed sometimes upon penitents as an act of penance. Now, Luther says this is nothing short of hypocrisy, even, he calls it, idolatry.
Then he turns to what he regards as two kinds of commendable fastings. What does he say there?
Yeah, well, Luther says there's two kinds of fasting that are really good. And then he goes on to talk about three. I suppose it depends a little bit on how you number them. There's certainly one that's in a category by itself that he talks about first. And then you could either consider the next two to be discrete items, or you consider them to be like 2A and 2B. The one that's certainly in a category by itself is what he calls civil fasting. We might today, especially if we remember like the kind of conditions that pertained in this country like during World War II, we'd call it rationing. In other words, you just have the government impose a fast, a refraining from sale of certain foods like meat certain days of the week, or from eating certain foods certain days of the week, just to preserve and conserve the overall food supply so we don't gobble it all up. That, he says, is simply a civil service. It is not a divine service. It doesn't pretend to be any kind of special devotional exercise at all. Then, he says, in the second category, there is the, he says, general spiritual fast. He says, and that could be a good thing. He recommends a few days before Christmas, Easter, and Pentecost that there be a fast. That would, among other things, spread the fasting out. You wouldn't have a fast and then a week or two later have another fast following right on its heels. And furthermore, and even more important, this would call attention to those great festivals of the church year, which are, after all, there to preach Christ to people. Luther said he could even go along with the idea of fasts every Friday evening, year-round, a general spiritual fast on Friday evenings. But, he says, I neither could nor would introduce such fasting unless it had been agreed upon harmoniously beforehand. So he's not going to go and try to burden people's conscience and say, you must do this, even though you're not necessarily interested in it or your heart may not be in it. But then he gets to that category we might call 2B, because he says even that kind of general spiritual fast is not even so much what Christ is talking about here in the Sermon on the Mount. Rather, Christ is talking about fasting that is appropriate to individual Christians. And Luther says it's important for us to understand that there's more to this kind of fasting than simply abstaining from food. What more is involved is the discipline and restraining, he says, of your body, which pertains not only to eating, drinking, and sleeping, but also to your leisure, your pleasure, and everything else that may delight your body or that you do to provide for it and take care of it. See, the objective here, Luther says, is that you curb the flesh. So what you're doing is humbling your body and withholding what pleases and gratifies your body. But even there, Luther warns, and again, it's no surprise to hear him saying this, do not rely on that kind of fasting as giving you some sort of special spiritual one-upmanship with God.
He does, and this is where we have to kind of sort out Luther carefully. He does talk about fasting to be a work and one that is pleasing to God, but not for the reasons that he deplores earlier, where someone thinks they are reconciling themselves or atoning for sin with fasting. What's he talking about?
Yeah, it's not fasting as an end in itself. It's fasting as a means to an end, as we've already been suggesting. I'll quote him here. He says, it takes many things, therefore, for fasting to be a truly good work and one pleasing to God. He wants nothing at all to do with you if by your fasting you court him as if you were a great saint, and yet meanwhile you nurse a grudge or anger against your neighbor. You see, what I call the real fasting of Christians means that you punish your whole body and compel it as well as all five senses to forsake and do without whatever makes life comfortable. But, and again, no surprise to hear him say this, I will not take it upon myself to prescribe this sort of fasting, nor will I impose it upon anyone else. And among other things, he's got a kind of a unique pastoral insight here. He says, we are not all alike, and so no one can set up a general rule. Everyone must impose or adjust the fasting in relation to his own strength and to his feelings about how much his own flesh requires. For this fasting is directed only against the lust and the passions of the flesh, not against nature itself. And here, I think, Todd, is the point that you were maybe asking about. What Luther is aiming at here with good, God-pleasing kind of fasting. Again, as I say, it's a means to an end, curbing the flesh. It's not simply to make war on your body. The problem here is not corporeality as such. And this is not a case, like the scholastics may have said in the Middle Ages, of grace perfecting nature. The problem remains the sinful flesh, the old Adam within the human being. And that's the thing that needs to be borne uppermost in mind. And again, Luther says not everybody is alike. Not everybody needs to treat his sinful nature in exactly the same way for the sake of disciplining it.
There's also a general goal that Luther will derive from Christ's admonition about fasting. What is that?
Well, here Luther sees the big picture, and he sort of says, well, what exactly is God wanting in his human creatures, fasting or not? He says everyone is commanded to live a moderate, sober, and disciplined life, not for one day or one year, but for every day and always. So Christians will do as much, among other things, eating, drinking, and sleeping as their need requires, not as much as their greedy appetite or whim requires. And we've got things like the 9th and 10th commandments, after all, to think about here. And so Luther says that Christians will not live as though the purpose of life were only eating and drinking and generally having a good time. Now, that's basically Luther's point in all this. And again, he says this all needs to come out of a heart that is reconciled to God on account of Christ. He says, above all, you must see to it that you are already pious and a true Christian and that you are not planning to render God a service by this fasting. See, this fasting is not to help God at all. It's not going to benefit him in the slightest. It will hopefully benefit you.
Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest, part 49 of our series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. We're in Luther's treatment of the Sermon on the Mount, fasting in Matthew chapter 6. When we come back, what would he do with the Lord's admonition about doing pious acts performed in secret?
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit wittenbergacademy.org.
When a Christian woman is critical of her own flesh, she holds her Creator in contempt.
Rose Adel from her new book, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Our Heavenly Father knit us together in the womb. He did not do a bad job. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. Psalm 139:14. That goes for everyone, including the one who thinks she's the ugliest of them all.
You can purchase and download Concordia Publishing House's new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically, at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes.
Keeping the message straight. Getting the message out. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our series, Martin Luther and the Reformation, continues with Dr. Ken Sherb, dealing with Luther's treatment of the Sermon on the Mount, coming to this part here, these few verses in Matthew chapter 6, where Jesus deals with the subject of fasting. More generally here, Ken, what does Luther say about the Lord's admonition regarding pious acts performed in secret?
Well, toward the end, yeah, of Luther's comments on these verses, Matthew 6, verses 16 through 18, he now says, okay, I've dealt with each of these things in passing, or in turn, just like Christ did. I've dealt with almsgiving, following what Christ said. I've dealt with prayer, following what he said. I've dealt with now fasting, as he said. We do have to glance back over our shoulder, though, Luther says, in effect, and look at one more thing, and it's that thread that runs throughout all of these three points that Christ makes. And he says that you should do your pious acts in secret. Now, Luther says this is really an important point for us to linger over. It is an important consolation for Christians who are diligent in doing good, and yet what they do ends up going unheralded, even unrecognized by the world. Todd, you don't necessarily have to be like the Pharisees that Jesus was talking about. really kind of fishing for compliments with everything you do in the way of your pious acts, to be disappointed if you never get so much as a notice or a kind word or an encouraging remark. Luther says, take our own case as an example. No one sees the good we accomplish by the grace of God. People denounce us, he says, like as if we forbid good works. Now, he's got Roman Catholic opponents in mind, but he's also, I think, got the Anabaptists in mind a bit here, too. He says these folks think of our gospel as heresy, and they do not see its fruits. And that's especially one of the challenges that the Anabaptists were laying down about this time, basically saying to Luther and the Lutherans, well, okay, if your doctrine is all that great, if it's really the Word of God, if it's really what Christ says, then you should be light years more advanced than us in your behavior. So where's the fruits, Luther? And Luther says, well, you may not see that much by way of ostensible fruit. But, he says, do not despair. You see, the whole of the Christian life has to be hidden and remain hidden this way. And again, he says, do not worry about the way it is hidden, covered up, and buried, and the way no one sees it or notices it. Be content with the fact that your Father up there in heaven sees it. The life of all Christians is intended for the eyes of God alone. It is enough that our action is intended to satisfy and to glorify the one who sees it. Then, why should we strive after the world's honor or its gratitude, which we cannot obtain? It's very much like St. Paul writing to the Colossians and saying, you have died and your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. It is a big temptation. And Luther knew this. He knew this not only for people like the Anabaptists, he knew it for people who were among the Lutheran camp, to try to track the good works in their life. And he said, no, your good works are going to remain hidden in many cases, even from your own eyes. But that's okay. Your Father in heaven sees, and he says, your Father in heaven rewards. And that's the other consolation here. Your Father will reward, and the reward will be seen even in this world. Luther thinks about John Huss. He said when John Huss, over 100 years earlier, was burned at the stake at the Council of Constance, people thought at the time that his name would be completely obliterated. And yet, now, Luther says, he is shining forth because Luther came to see that a lot of the things he was saying were very similar to things that John Huss had already said in the 15th century. He says, for the work and the word of God cannot remain in obscurity. It must come forth into the light, regardless of how deeply it is covered up and buried. And maybe the banner example of that is Christ himself, who was, after all, not only crucified, but, as the Creed says, dead and buried. But then, as Luther puts it, he flashed forth, and his word has been widely proclaimed ever since to the salvation of many people. And so Luther sums up and says, this ought to make us feel safe too. For we have his word, we have Christ's word, that though our preaching and works may be hidden now, they must come to light and be praised in the presence of all the world. That is, unless God himself stays in the dark.
Dr. Ken Sherb is pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. He has a PhD in history from Ohio State University and formerly served as a theology professor at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Ken, thank you, and look forward to our next conversation.
Good epiphany theme there, right, Todd? Keep it shining.
In Hour 2 of Issues Etc., we're going to spend some time with David DeLeiden, founder of the Center for Medical Progress. You'll remember that David was much in the news because he developed and executed the Center Human Capital's investigation documenting Planned Parenthood's illegal sale of body parts of aborted babies. Well, the House has issued their final report, a select panel of the U.S. House of Representatives on infant lives. We're going to talk about what they found there and what it means for the future of Planned Parenthood, especially since the House is talking about defunding Planned Parenthood. David Dalyden will be with us, and then Wesley Smith will join us to talk about bioethics in 2017.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.